recording that. You don't need to start yet. But...
Well, good morning from New York. Rainy day here at InvestNet's offices at 49 Fifth Ave. My name is Jim Patrick. I'm a board member of the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard, sitting around a table with a bunch of folks. So we look forward to taking some time with you this morning. And I think what we'll do is have some prepared remarks initially from Knut Rostad and a few others, and then we'll open it up and have a bit of a roundtable. So thank you again for taking the time. You know, at InvestNet, we were founded in 1999 to enable advisory businesses. So we have fiduciary roots, if you will. And our mandate is to not just be the best in the industry, but be the best for the industry as an organization. We have 42,000 advisors and almost $1 trillion that we serve. And as we sat with about half of that last week in terms of client engagements, We heard a lot of confusion from our clients around regulation, around what advisors should be doing, and we heard a lot of confusion around sort of next steps. But what we weren't hearing any confusion about was the importance of better education and better clarity for the end client. And so to that end, we're very excited to have Knut Rostad, the founder and head of the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard, in what is really a remarkable time to be thinking about best practices and the importance of best practices as we look to raise the bar of the ultimate consumer through an advisor, which we think is very important. So, Knut?
Thank you, Jim. And thank you all who are joining us via conference call, as well as those around the table here in New York. Just a couple or one or two housekeeping notes. I would ask everyone to keep their phone on mute while we go through the remarks and opening presentations. And then when you would like to, when we open it up to Q&A and would like to pose a question, to please identify who you are and your affiliation, and then ask the question. So I think that's it in terms of opening housekeeping. Today we are going to start off with some preliminary introductory remarks by Vanguard founder John C. Bogle, and then I will follow with some opening remarks, and then I will be followed by Brian Hamburger, who is the general counsel to the Best Practices Board, and then we will hear from three individuals who are on our industry panel about their views of the best practices. The first one is Brian Beatty. He's a member of the Best Practices Board. And then Dave O'Brien, who is here from NAPFA. And then Michael Wazowski, who is also a member or a director of the Chairman's Council. So to start off then, Jack, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome, and thank you for joining us. And if you could share your thoughts with the group now, that would be great.
Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Jack Bogle. I've been involved in this fiduciary issues for, well, I was going to say all my life, but it's a little bit less than that, and even tried to create a company that had the optimal prospects for acting as a true fiduciary. That's why Vanguard is a mutual company, owned by its own shareholders and lacks the kind of conflicts of interest that others in the industry face when they have public stockholders, or even worse, when they're owned by a financial conglomerate. And something like 40 out of the largest 50 mutual fund groups have this basically conflict of interest. They have two masters to serve, the management company and the funds, and there's a fiduciary duty to both. So yesterday in Washington, the SEC held its own anniversary, 75th anniversary of the Investment Company Act of 1940, and I was the principal industry participant and actually almost the only one, and we had a pretty good session there all day with previous commissioners. We did not get into the fiduciary area in a technical sense, in that there's still this kind of internecine division between the responsibilities of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the responsibilities of the Department of Labor for retirement plans. And retirement plans are, of course, as all of you probably know, almost one half of the assets of the mutual fund industry. And that's a cool number, like 8 trillion out of 16 trillion. So both agencies have to be involved ultimately. But my last words were relevant to where we are this morning. And my last words, they said, what advice would you give to anybody entering the business? And I said, put the client first. I probably should have added, because Newt would have liked that, that means a federal standard of fiduciary duty, and I believe we'll ultimately get that. Your meeting is very timely, because there's an op-ed in the New York Times this morning on this very issue of fiduciary duty by Lily Batchelder and Jared Bernstein. Lily was on the White House staff for quite a while. She's a professor at a university in New York and a really smart, wonderful person. And we saw eye to eye as all this Department of Labor kept trying its work to establish the standard. Unfortunately, it's being nibbled to death by the fund industry and by the lobbyists. And they all start their letters. Oh, I'm going to be a little bit hyperbolic here. We absolutely agree in the need for a fiduciary standard. And then they give 15 pages to the huge changes they envision that have to be made and for them to agree to back it. And some of the changes are necessary, to be fair, and I presume will be accommodated, because the end goal in sight, a fiduciary standard for investment advisors and brokers, just has to be the way this business runs. It's the honorable way to run a business, and it also does something that Adam Smith said a couple of years ago, say 1776, when he said the ultimate purpose of any business is to serve the consumer, not for the producers to serve themselves, but to serve their consumers. And that's obviously the way things have to work, finally. And it takes a little time to get to it in the business which find ourselves. But these introductory standards, these best practices that you will be talking about today are a wonderful step along the way. I think you are all aware that getting to where we need to be in a fiduciary standard for retirement plan advisors, registered advisors and brokers, is going to be a fight. It's being fought out in Congress in a couple of days. And we presume that the Department of Labor will still be able to bring out it's an administrative act and not a legislative act. But we shall see. But if all of us work together, I'm highly confident that we can get down in writing what we all know in our hearts is the right thing to do.
Well, thank you, Jack. Thank you for your remarks.
Well, I'm sorry I can't be with you today. I'm very interested in the subject, but having spent a day in Washington yesterday, it takes me a day to work it off.
Well,
and it was nice to see you down
Washington
there, too,
by the
way.
We'll do that to anybody, Jack. So I can understand that. I'm sure there'll be some questions, particularly for you, so I hope you can stay on the line and so you can take those questions.
I have a little trouble doing that, so why don't we, if there are any questions for me, could we possibly take them now?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And there may not be any questions. I mean, I think everybody agrees with the generalities that I've expressed.
Everybody agrees. That's right. That's right. Okay.
What kind of responses have you gotten from your colleagues in the fund industry and at ICI directly? This is Jed Horowitz from Reuters.
Well,
did you hear that, Jack?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
It's about what my colleagues in the industry, and one of them, my former assistant here at Vanguard, and actually my number two person in those days when we were tiny and growing, who left us for T. Rowe Price, young Wharton grad he was when I hired him, and left to work for T. Rowe Price and became one of the leaders there, and he was on the panel too. He's retired, and this kid I hired all those years ago, I don't know what's the matter with me, but he expresses very much still an industry viewpoint, and that is we all put the client first. They don't realize that there's this bar or this second interest in their own profitability. And T. Rowe Price has been an enormously profitable stock, unbelievable, and far better than any of their funds could ever do. So the managers have all prospered, not necessarily by owning the funds that they manage, but by owning the management company. I mean, this is a hugely profitable business. And that money comes out of the pockets of the shareholders who are paying these fees that establish such huge profit margins. So the industry thinks it's doing right. Everybody says our costs are below average. And probably everybody who is of large size in this industry, every firm that's of large size, their costs are below average. But the average cost of the funds, are claimed by the Investment Company Institute to be 70, I think it's 72 basis points, and there are actually 82 basis points, something like a 10 basis point spread if you take out index funds. So costs are still very high, and they're higher than they were when I came into this business way back in 1951. So they're a little bit captive of this famous quote by Upton Sinclair, and that is amazing how difficult it is for somebody to understand something if they're paid a small fortune not to understand it. And, we all defend our own positions. I think we all believe in our own positions. And so I accept their earnestness. but not their conclusions.
Thank you, Jack. Any other questions for Jack Bogle? Yes?
Hi, Jack. This is Megan Munhart from wealthmanagement.com. You mentioned that the rule is the DOL fiduciary rule is being sort of nibbled to death by, you know, the fund companies and lobbyists and others opposed to issues. But you did also mention that you're highly confident that, you know, we can get down in writing, you know, what we all know is true in our hearts, if I'm quoting correctly. You know, where do you see, you know, this coming down in the end? And, you know, you mentioned getting everything in writing.
Yeah, well, let me say this. I'm pretty sure that what will come out of this will be a fiduciary standard for registered investment advisors and broker-dealers. Because that's, I mean, maybe I'm an idealist, maybe I'm just naive, but it's so obviously the right thing to do. I do think the laws originally written, or the regulation as originally written, is maybe over complex, and it can be simplified, it can be generalized, it can be more principles-based rather than case-by-case. I think what we want to do here is establish the principle. Let's get it down somehow. And if we have to concede certain points along the way to get there, I, for one, would concede them, depending on the points. And they can't go to the integrity of the principle of fiduciary duty. But some of the record-keeping requirements, all of those kind of things, it is complicated. And there are hundreds of pages involved in all this, hundreds of pages of Department of Labor work. And then I think somebody said they had 300,000 comments on it. I mean, I wouldn't even know where to begin. I come into my office, and if I've got 50 things waiting for me, I'm overwhelmed. I don't know what I would do with 300,000. So it's basically looking at the end game in when you have to compromise. Just make sure you get to your end objective and try to make it more principles-based. Try to simplify it, and you won't overcome everybody's objections, but I think you will be able to get enough of a consensus to get it done.
Thank you, Jack.
Okay, and good luck to all of you. Have a great day.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Now, I will have a few remarks right here to continue. Today is September 30th, the last day of fiduciary September 2015. So if I sound a little sad on occasion, now you know why that might be. Today's briefing is the final of four events, two white papers, and a research survey we did along with wealthmanagement.com that we produced this fiduciary September. And for that, I want to note also our exclusive sponsor of fiduciary September, TD Ameritrade Institutional, for their great support for what we are doing. Thank you, TD. Today, the Institute releases its best practices for financial advisors. The best practices have been developed by the Best Practices Board, which is comprised of four practitioners and myself. Brian Beatty, who is here around the table with us this morning, is on the Best Practices Board, as is Clark Blackman, Chris Cannon, and Bill Pruitt. The Best Practices Board has labored conscientiously over the past 18 months to meet the objectives and set by the Institute Board of Directors. For that, we are very appreciative. Also, at this point, I want to note that a partner of the Institute's in this project has been NAPFA, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. And, in fact, Dave O'Brien, who is sitting here this morning, is sitting with his association with NAPFA. I'm going to address one basic question in my opening remarks, and that is, why best practices? Why do we need them? The reason for us is fairly straightforward, why investors, the industry, and the markets need best practices. Best practices are needed to fulfill a fiduciary promise to investors. That is the promise to be competent, to be ethical, to be professional. The promise to defend and protect and to serve investors first. Many investors believe this promise has been broken. Broken by the harms of conflicted advice and the ill will and distrust brought on by public displays of bad behavior from and throughout the financial crisis. this ill will continues to mark the post-crisis era today. This ill will has not been mitigated by federal regulations or by many good faith industry efforts thus far, efforts which provide important guidance technically, but do not do enough in our view and have not kept up with the demands of the post-crisis era on the ethical side of advice. They do not address what the new skeptical investor demands today. We are at a historic moment in 2015. It's the 71st anniversary of the Investment Advisors Act, as Jack mentioned. The SEC was noting that yesterday, where he spoke on a lead panel. And that we see, so at this time, we see stalled SEC rulemaking on a uniform standard as the DOL pushes ahead to update ERISA. We see persistent and historically high levels of investor distrust, distrust in 2015 reminiscent of the 1930s, according to Boston University scholar Tamar Frankel. The CFA Institute 2015 Global Market Sentiment Survey of more than 3,500 CFA holders finds 96% agree the investment industry has a trust problem, and 63% agree the greatest contributing factor is a lack of an ethical culture within financial firms. CFA charterholders most often mentioned solution to address the problem of 30% believe is a better alignment of compensation practices with investor objectives. This is followed by zero tolerance policy by top management for ethical breaches. On top of this, just last week, CFP Board released a survey further documenting the magnitude of investor distrust, where in one particular question, by a margin of 60% to 25%, investors said that financial advisors act in their company's best interest as opposed to financial advisors acting in consumers' best interest. So one can ask, what can advisors do? One researcher, Harris Interactive executive Robert Franck, says it straight and simply, quote, the public is screaming loud and clear, be more sincere, be more honest, be more transparent. Franck is correct to focus on the importance of transparency regarding restoring investor trust. And no other than the leader of the thundering herd apparently agrees with him. Merrill Lynch's John Thiel told Investment News just last year that industry practices on fee and expense opaqueness fall short and aggravate investor skepticism and distrust. But he went further than that. He suggested that this is why Merrill's own clients don't trust Merrill, and that this is, and that what Merrill has to do is to be transparent in terms of fees and expenses. And he went on and named three different areas where that has to happen. Distrustful investors demand more information, they ask more questions, and they look at the company behind the advisor. Most of all, they seek action. Language expert and researcher Michael Malansky says, words in the absence of deeds will fail, period. The Institute's best practices address this challenge. They seek to help investors evaluate advisors and whether they offer objective, competent, and transparent advice. Practices are crafted to be concrete, understandable, and verifiable, and stress the ethical side of fiduciary advice. Practices focus on the importance of avoiding conflict. They focus on transparency and improving communications. Advisors should embrace best practices and the high standard investors expect. Stating adherence to best practices is important and a good start, but let's be clear, it by itself is not enough. We must do more. Advisors must demonstrate adherence to the practices, provide evidence that our deeds match our words. Only then will trust in advisors really be restored. Further, advisors should speak out in the public square about best practices and why they matter to investors. We can no longer let bad behavior of some financial firms splashed in the media define advisors. When competent and ethical advisors do nothing, that's exactly what happens. So kudos to CFA Institute for its future finance campaign and for calling for naming and shaming, and kudos to FPA President Ed Gibson for urging FPA members to speak out as well. Advisors must demonstrate our commitment to achieving excellence. And in that spirit, this morning, the Institute calls on Merrill Lynch to help lead the industry as it has done for generations by embracing the best practices and adopting them as their own. Increased fee and expense transparency, just as Don Thiel has suggested. Embrace best practices, help restore investor trust and confidence. Our next step in terms of the Institute is to help advisors achieve meeting the practices. The Institute will work with Market Council to develop a self-assessment tool for advisors to measure their adherence to best practices. Brian Hamburger will highlight this initiative shortly. Also in the weeks ahead, the Institute will announce an initiative to craft an Investor Bill of Rights, an initiative aimed to translate best practices into a few key ideas around which investors can better appreciate what really counts and embodying excellent advisors. In summary, the Institute seeks to help investors evaluate advisors' adherence to the practices, to work with advisors on embracing the practices, and to explain in the public square why they are so important. So with those remarks, I will now turn the microphone over to Brian Hamburger.
Thank you, Knut. Today is a very important day. So as Knut mentioned, or as Jack mentioned yesterday, marked the 75th anniversary of the Investment Advisors Act and the Investment Company Act as recognized by the SEC. Today may be the last day in fiduciary September, but trying to be the eternal optimist, tomorrow is the first day leading up to fiduciary September 2016. So perfect day for us to be sitting here rolling out and announcing the best practices for financial advisors. It's been an honor to be asked to serve as general counsel to this board, and I'm proud of the work that the board has accomplished to date, but as Knut said, our work is not yet done. Far from it. What brought me here is this word fiduciary, and industry pundits have used this word fiduciary, some accurately, some downright recklessly, but either way, without really laying a path for financial advisors to achieve them. So the term itself, the use of the term, has been increased. It's murkiness at best. The reality is almost all advisors you speak to think that they're acting in their client's best interest, or they have their client's best interests at heart, or that they wouldn't do anything to harm their clients. So to simply use the term fiduciary, to simply say that you have to act in your client's best interest, is simply not enough to bring about the type of behavior that we think is so important to bring transformation and evolution to this industry. I am particularly proud of the work that we've done here in contrast to the lack of regulatory support. So while Jack is probably far more optimistic than I am that the regulators will come about with a uniform fiduciary standard, I was more moved by this notion in looking at this and saying, hey, after some time, the industry needs to do more than complain that the regulators aren't taking action. And these standards are a nudge in the right direction, regardless of whether the regulators take action. The criteria here in developing these standards is we wanted them to be objective, we wanted them to be clear, and we wanted them to be measurable. We wanted these standards to maintain the very best of investment advice while maintaining an open architecture to recognize the various practices that have made this industry so great. This all comes down to a dozen best practices. And what probably speaks most loudly is what's not here. It's the more simple that we can make these standards, the more easy we can make them to understand for not only financial advisors and not only for consumers, but yes, also for regulators, the more likely we are to achieve some type of consensus. So I'm really proud of the work and congratulate Knut and the rest of the board for their work here. I'd like to introduce the three members from the industry response panel. To my immediate right is Michael Wazowski. Next to him is Dave O'Brien, and next to him is Brian Beatty. And Michael, you want to start us off?
With pleasure. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Knut, for bringing us together today. My name is Michael Wazowski. I work at Manchester Capital Management. We are a private family office caring for $3 billion on behalf of 40 families around the U.S. And I would like to share with you why I became involved in the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard. After 25 years in the industry, I felt I owed a debt of gratitude, not only back to the industry that has taken care of me for my whole career, but also to our investors who ultimately support our industry. And I heard Knut present on the fiduciary standard at a conference last year, and coincidentally I heard Michael Zerner, one of the board members, founding board members of the Institute, talk about what is a family office. And it raised two things for me. One is awareness that there's a lot of confusion around vocabulary and around complexity and around regulation in our industry. I don't even want to say that it is purposefully misleading, but it is certainly confusing to investors, just the vocabulary that's used. And second, that there is a light, and I think the Institute is one of the shining lights, helping to educate investors and helping to guide investors and to find their way through the complexities of the financial industry. And I wanted to be part of that education process, so I helped to start a chairman's council of other registered investment advisors who had a similar vision and a similar passion that we shared with the Institute and that we've put together both for the purpose of providing feedback in the development of best practices and using our own professional and personal spheres of influence to educate investors that we could reach one-on-one. I'll share a simple model that I carry in my mind to show where the best practices fit in for a moment. And I draw parallel to the food industry, so I think it's a little bit simpler than the financial industry. And I have a responsibility as a member of a family for putting together a balanced meal program for my family. There are a few ways I could do that. I could go directly to a food supplier, let's say a bakery shop, and I could shop myself. I could even maybe ask for some advice on what the best dessert might be that day. I could go to a supermarket that provides a much broader range of options, one-stop shopping, convenience, maybe some advice, maybe some menus. Or I could approach a registered dietitian, and I could describe to them my taste, my family's health situation, and they could, after interviewing me, help me put together a balanced plan and also help me shop for the highest quality ingredients at the lowest possible cost on behalf of my family. Of course, in exchange, I would have to pay them a fee for their service, and that would be a visible, transparent fee. And I think I could get the meal plan done in any of those three scenarios. And I can get my portfolio built in any of the financial services scenarios as well. The difference in financial services is it's very hard to recognize when are you dealing with a producer of food, when are you dealing with a supermarket, and when are you dealing with an objective professional advisor who has no inventory that they need to turn over. And I think what the fiduciary best practices accomplish is they define both for the professionals and for the investors when you're dealing with that objective professional. And that's all I'll say for now.
Thank you, Michael. I love the analogy, and I have viewed it that way myself. Thank you. We just, on the phone, we just had an adjustment, so the phone's a little closer. I'm Dave O'Brien. I'm the chair of NAPFA's Public Policy Committee. I hope all of you know NAPFA is the association of fee-only and fiduciary financial advisors. Since we were founded in 1983, we've embraced the high ideal of independent and objective advice for consumers. And that's supported by the tenets in our code of ethics and our fiduciary oath, which all of our members must affirm annually. The best practices really support NAPSA goals of advancing the fiduciary cause to protect consumers and elevating the ethical and educational requirements for advisors. We believe that financial planning will be the first newly recognized profession of the 21st century and an important stone toward that path, or towards that goal. Is an objective set of practices and principles that advisors and consumers can point to when identifying someone providing fiduciary level advice, which we don't have objectively today. We are hopeful that the propagation of best practices through the industry by practitioners is a way to generate change that will fundamentally change the way that the industry functions. We've heard discussions about what are the regulators going to do, and certainly there are a lot of activities there. That is one approach that's being taken, and another is that the practitioners themselves must embrace the higher standards. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Brian Beatty, and I'm a partner at Eganberger & Weiner in Vienna, Virginia, and I actually cleared through a broker-dealer. So maybe it would be best if I start with the description about channels. To some degree, you have the opportunity in this business to license directly with the SEC, where you that's your reporting requirement. You can register with a broker-dealer, and you have various types of broker-dealers that you can work with. You can work with broker-dealers that are also market makers and principal traders and investment banks, or you can work with a broker-dealer that doesn't make markets or do any investment banking. And you, by and large, are your own employer, and you design your own business model. I am of that channel, the independent broker-dealer world. I've been in the business 25 years, and I've seen a lot of changes, but I've always been in the independent channel where I think I've seen the most change. And the majority of all of our client relationships are fee-based advisory relationships with our clients, and we are a personalized financial planning firm. So my interest in serving in this cause is that I think the public generally does not understand there are different ways that they can engage. They just do not know. I agree they don't understand the terminology in our industry, which I would agree is purposefully vague and opaque and hard to understand to the advantage of the industry itself. But I think it's important for the general public to know who it is they're working with, what capacity it is they're working with them, and whose interests are being served when they're in a relationship. And I think it can be done in my channel, provided you choose the right business model and you choose the right broker-dealer. And so after this fiduciary September, we'll be having a council of dual registrants and or independent broker-dealer advisors to help kind of go forth and spread the gospel about your business design and how you can actually implement these best practices in the way you do business with clients and kind of build a momentum inside the independent broker-dealer channel where more practices choose to operate this way. And so that's what I hope to achieve.
Thank you, Brian. At this time, I'd like to open up for questions from our friends in the media. And so I know we've got some other friends of the Institute on the line, but I'd like to let our friends from the media sort of lead the way and go first in terms of these questions. So the floor is open. If you're in any case, please identify yourself and your affiliation before you ask the question.
Hi, I'm Juliet Fairley with Financial Advisor Magazine, and I'm curious as to whether implementing some of these best practices for financial advisors
whether there's a cost?
Well, I guess I'll start. You can all jump in here. This is Brian Beatty. Yes, there's a cost. The cost is software. The cost is time and energy to write standards, to implement and share with your clients. There are reports that need to be generated. So there's a cost, but I wouldn't call it a prohibitive cost. So this is probably a good time to say, well, why would someone have a broker-dealer? Because I know that question comes up all the time. One of the reasons someone might have a broker-dealer is because they can help aggregate costs, provide economies of scale for the access to technology, and they can add compliance overlay for folks who are just starting out. You don't start out with a book of business usually. Usually you have to find your clients. And so sometimes these economies of scale really help an advisor design the correct practice. And maybe at some point in time there is no economy of scale for that RIA, and they shed the broker-dealer, that might happen. But I see it as a very reason why someone would actually choose a broker-dealer to handle license compliance and economies of scale and technology and report.
Did you want
to? Julia, tell me if that is your question, because the way I perceive your question is there a fee, right, to?
Well, to implement the best practices for financial advisors to adopt this, what these 12 best practices, is there any, what would the cost be? So, and yeah, if there's a fee, what is the cost of getting up to speed with these best practices? I understand, like, the software, what kind of software would there be? What, you know, are they going to have to revamp their system in the office?
So I think Brian raises a good, you know, a great point, which is I think we need to, in order to raise this to a profession, in order to evolve this to actually running a business, we need to stamp out along the way this fallacy that there's zero cost of entry to this business, that there's zero operating costs that exist to do it well, right? Understand that these best practices are aspirational. We hope that the best advisors, the advisors that are accomplishing their fiduciary or showing their fiduciary standard, can illustrate by use of these best practices. This is not a minimum threshold. This is just what we see, what the board sees as the best advisors doing to accomplish these best practices. There's a cost. There are various costs to running your business and running it well, to make sure that there's accurate and timely reporting, to make sure that there are checks and balances, to make sure that there are ways in which to supervise staff, and they vary by business model. These best practices were designed to be business model neutral. You heard Knut in his opening remarks call upon Merrill Lynch to achieve these best practices. Similarly, there can be a one-man investment advisory firm who also achieves these best practices. These are aspirational, and depending upon where folks are within their current business, that'll depend upon what cost. I can assure you that it's going to be a little more costly for Merrill Lynch to achieve these best practices than a one-person financial fee-only advisory firm to achieve these best practices.
Maybe I'll offer an answer to Juliet. This is Michael Vershavsky. I just want to point out that the fiduciary standard is not new. The Investor Advisors Act is 75 years old, and that it was established with a very similar purpose in mind, which was to review existing advisory practices, identify how they could be tightened and improved to favor investors, and to stamp out some misdeeds that were detected in an SEC study. And they really created what later became defined through legal analysis as the fiduciary standard for registered investment advisors. And there are a number of investment advisors that are following these practices already for many, many years. So for those advisors, there is not a cost. I think the real benefit is for investors, and I think the real cost is getting the message out and getting the education out to investors, and that's an investment in time, that's an investment in money. There, of course, I agree with Brian Hamburger that there might be some businesses that need to make certain adjustments because they might not have the tools or the technology. They might not have been set up from the start that way. They might like to be set up that way. And the last thing I'll point out is there is an opportunity cost, I think, more than a layout, because it does mean saying no to certain types of businesses. It does mean saying no to certain types of financial opportunities.
and to certain types of income streams. And I think that is not felt as a cost, but I think it does create a different margin in the business, and you really have to have a passion and a vision for client service in order to espouse these types of practices.
Sure, this is Dave O'Brien. I'll speak briefly on that. I think there, and I agree with Michael. I mean, on the RIA side, I think this is easy for us. From a technology standpoint, specifically, there have been some questions around the reporting requirements or best practices associated with reporting, which I frankly feel is not something that would add cost because I know my firm already has the tools to do that. It's really the best practice of doing, you know, that certain annual reporting for a client. So maybe that's a development expense for certain software vendors, but I really don't view that as incremental expense to an RIA firm. Maybe another way to look at this is what's the cost on investors if more advisors don't adopt these best practices? We know how much more money they spend today, how many people are getting a fairly opaque relationship with an advisor, being sold products that are taking their money and putting it into an advisor's pocket. I think the cost to society is fairly great if more professionals don't follow this approach in the work that they do.
Thank you, Dave. Any next question?
I have two. The first one's very general, and I'll just throw it out to all of you.
Could you identify yourself?
Jed Horowitz, Reuters. All of you on the committee, of the 12 best practices, which do you think will be most difficult for people to really adhere to, and which caused the most discussion among you guys?
I'll speak. This is Dave O'Brien. Certainly, from a NAP perspective, this certainly aligns with what we've been about since 1983. As I said, this is relatively easy for us. The reporting was an area where there were some opportunities to operationalize it in a practical manner where you are able to fulfill the best practice. For example, what is the anticipated cost of trading this coming year? Well, we may not know exactly what the transaction cost would be for any given client, but we can provide, you know, an estimate. That's the type of area where, you know, identifying what's practical. I would say from speaking with some colleagues who are not fee only, you know, to Michael's point, there's an opportunity cost when you are looking at certain transactions that you may not be able to, or they may not be able to continue to engage in.
Which number was that?
That's number 7, actually. And that's one I was going to hit on. This is Brian Baker. For a lot of people, they migrate over time in this business, sometimes not quick enough. They start out selling something because they need to make an income to be in the business, and maybe they're from that model. The difficult thing is you get used to a lifestyle. That's created by the type of things that you offer your clients. It develops a revenue stream. As Michael pointed out, you're going to have to at some point in time turn away, whether that's real estate investment trusts with large upfront commissions, which supplements the advisory work you do side by side, and that's one of those times when hats are changed, supposedly, in this business, which we don't think should be possible, or whether it's walking away from high commission annuities with large surrender charges. The idea is simply that if you want to adopt these practices, you're going to have to change some of your behavior as an advisor. So the end result of practice 7 would be to change the industry from the inside out as more people choose to walk away from these revenue streams. Not that these products aren't important, because they are, because these are a tool to achieve rates of return, to lower risk of portfolios, to create market efficiencies and so forth. But they don't have to be used the way they've been used in the past, and they certainly deserve to be disclosed as to how much compensation is received from using these products. Now, if you don't hold yourself out as a fiduciary, then, you know, have at it. But the idea here is that you're saying that there's a difference between this relationship from another relationship. And so if you want to hold yourself out as a fiduciary, these things, you're going to have to give them up.
Thank you, Brian.
You know, could I have one thing? It's Jim Patrick. I look at number four and Brian's comment around it will be more difficult for some than for others to not only record but to administer these. A firm like Merrill Lynch, if you read number four, there are not necessarily the journal entries and the flow of funds easily captured. And as a technology provider, these are the kinds of things that we're asked about often, and to report on those, fee leveling, flow of payments, et cetera, that becomes a real challenge. Because of the way the industry's grown up and evolved, quote unquote, to accommodate these fees.
I think the biggest challenge is number one, right? And that's, just look at where the lobbying dollars are, right? And the lobbying dollars are, are you willing to affirm that you're indeed acting in a fiduciary capacity? And so that to me is the tipping point. From that point on, I think all of this other stuff becomes relatively easy. There is, I applaud what Knut has assembled here because there's a real diversity of interest here. Knut and I have argued long into the night, for and against the coverage of the fiduciary obligation for broker-dealers. But regardless of where regulation takes us, the decision to act in accordance with the fiduciary standard for your clients and for you to affirm that in writing, to me, is far and away the most difficult one of these things.
Can people on the line still hear despite someone's music on hold? Is there anyone on the line?
I can hear okay.
Oh, you can hear okay?
Yeah, it's a little distracting, but we can still hear you.
Okay, sorry.
They put up at all, but they can't hear that. Right?
Yeah. I think they're done. If someone on the line just put us on hold, please don't do that because we hear your music on hold.
And that's what they say to you. Tell us that. If they can hear us, I'd like to comment on the question of number four regarding the statement of total fees and expenses. There is no doubt that to pull together the total level of detail is going to be challenging for anyone. But let's be very clear about what is being required here and how that requirement can be met. And I think the point is that it is unfathomable. Sense to which very smart investors believe that they're getting free services every which way they go. They will pass a lie detector test saying that they don't pay for anything. And that is unfathomable, and that is worse than that. And so the key objective of number four is through an annual accounting of fees and expenses, which can be met by a good faith estimate in writing that we will contribute towards addressing that situation where hopefully make investors more aware of the fact that there are underlying fees and expenses that you are paying and that they are often not irrelevant at all. Sometimes they're very relevant. So I think that's the point that needs to be kept in mind here in terms of what's required in number four.
I want to make an observation. This is Michael Verschowski. One of the things that I think is admirable about the work of the Institute, and of course I'm biased because I've been involved now for a long time, is that it really, first thing, there's no profit motive, it's not for profit, and second thing, there is a huge effort to be inclusive, irrespective of regulatory model, irrespective of business model, irrespective of type of practice, to really just think about investors and to put together the practices in a straightforward way that will allow us to serve investors in the best way that we know how, based on the collected wisdom and all the feedback we've received from the public on the practices. Having said that,
I don't think it's realistic to think that there is going to be a large movement in the industry towards fiduciary best practices. Certainly, I don't think it's, I think there will still be a separation of people who create, provide, sell, and distribute terrific financial products. And that has a different set of responsibilities and requirements from an investor perspective, but doesn't have the requirements to provide fully objective advice, like asking the baker to provide fully objective nutritional advice. That is not a realistic expectation. So to me, the idea of a uniform fiduciary standard that applies to any institution that has financial services offerings on their platform, I don't think it's realistic. But I think it does help to define three camps. Who are the people who are providing and selling products? Who are the people who are offering fiduciary objective advice? And who are the business models that choose hybrid combinations of these, which may have different balances between one side and the other, and hopefully are offering clarity about when they're providing fiduciary advice and when they are providing other types of services that do not constitute fiduciary advice. So I think we should expect practically that there are going to be these different approaches, and really our mission is to narrowly and carefully define what is objective fiduciary advice.
Thank you, Michael. Did that add?
I was just going to do a follow-up to Brian, writing out the fiduciary standard. Is that because of potential liability?
No.
That you're saying this?
No, it's not because of potential liability. It's because of the opportunity cost in all of the other lines of business that you may not be able to pursue to the detriment of the client's trusted relationship. I think liability may constitute a portion of that, but I don't think that's close to it.
I could add, this is Brian Beatty. That's probably why certain accounts won't be able to do this, and that's probably okay. We just want them to be clear. And if we can get them to be clear about which of these roles they're fulfilling to the public, that's pretty good, because it's a far cry from what we're dealing with today.
Consider putting something in there about not using the word advisor.
Excellent question.
I'll tell you an interesting historical artifact. In the 1940 Advisors Act, the word investment counselor is reserved. But that reservation, and I think that, you know, similar, when you're putting a bank deposit, you have certain expectations and you have certain requirements in terms of making it clear to your client, this is a deposit, this is not a deposit, this is protected by the FDIC insurance, this is not. It would be nice to have similar concepts around advice, but even in the 1940 Act, that vision is defeated because it allows advice that is what is the phrase?
Wholly incidental.
Thank you very much, Jed. That is incidental to the sale of a product. So I think the word advice is not going to become a reserved word, unfortunately. And it is up to investors to educate themselves as to what type of advice they're getting in which scenario.
But in a perfect world, to answer your question, it would be nice if that word was reserved. Unfortunately, it's not.
Well, the baker and the butcher can't call themselves nutritionists. Long before
their advice is the best one. Right.
You know, you go to a butcher, you know, if you want a good cut of meat. That's great. But you know,
the nutritionist actually won't know.
It's, you know, you might find a butcher who's going to say, stop eating so much steak.
Try the lamb instead.
Right.
Any other questions?
I had a few. I'm Megan Lenhart with Wealth Management. I wanted to unpack a few things that you had mentioned in your opening statement. You talked about, up next you're going to have some kind of self-assessment. I know when the best practices were initially rolled out and, you know, up for discussion, that you had talked about having some kind of governing process for folks who do sign up to adhere to these practices. What is being done in that regard?
We absolutely believe that in this day and age that there's got to be some way of providing verification. You simply cannot be living in the real world in 2015 with investors today, in my view, in our view, and not deal with the issue of verification. That is a process. The first step to get to that process is through a self-assessment, which we are working on with Market Council. So I can't speak in more detail about what that form of verification looks like right now, except to say that we've got to have it. If we're going to win back investors, we've got to have it. And to not have it is like looking at 2016 to 2020 and picking up your business plan for 2005. How many firms would pick up their business plan for 2005 and say we're all set for 2016? I suggest not many, and I think that's a reasonable parallel.
I think, and this is Michael Zerner, board member of the Institute. I would just add to that that the Volkswagen incident teaches us that certification is a tricky process, and so what we don't want is a certification process where advisors will become quote-unquote certified but then continue to still spew pollution, right, at unbelievable levels into the environment. And I think we need to be extremely thoughtful about how we approach it, given what we've all just learned.
And I could comment on that a little further, Megan. I think there's two sides that need to be built up after today. So starting tomorrow, which is the first day leading up to fiduciary September 2016. And those two sides are, number one, that self-assessment tool, right? It's not only me walking out of here thinking that I eat a healthy diet, but objectively putting in my week's, month's worth of food into a system that comes back and rates how well I'm doing, how much progress I've made, how aspirationally how healthy is my diet, right? It's not what I think, because everyone thinks that they're acting in the client's best interest, or it's being able to measure that. And this is not, the objective here was never to create another cop on the beat. There are going to be bad actors, and so the other development that's being done in parallel with the self-assessment is this investor bill of rights, because until investors demand that level of accountability, until they demand the objective advice, until they can tell the difference between one and the other, then you can't expect the industry to take much interest in this, aside from a bunch of geeks sitting around a table talking about the fiduciary standard and what that actually means. All right, so the true demand has to come from investors. It can't be industry-driven. And when that happens, the acceleration will be amazing.
Sorry, just to sort of follow up on that, you mentioned that you don't want another cop on the beat. This wasn't the focus of this, but at the same time, Brian, I know your remarks today, Knut, certainly in the past, you've sort of mentioned that this is meant to be business model neutral, that you want folks to really look at this. Was there any sense that this was a guidepost for investors, or for regulators, excuse me, to take up this mantle and sort of work it into their potential fiduciary rulemaking?
I could speak personally and tell you that I have no expectations for regulators to move based upon what we're doing here. If there is any action, I'm not all that skeptical, because if there is any action, it will be on minimum standards to achieve the definition of fiduciary. I also think that because of the art of compromise in politics, it'll be devoid of so many of the details that practitioners so badly need to map their way around any potential unforeseen pitfalls. So this is an industry, this is not an industry response. Industry response would indicate that there's some type of regulatory action. This is the industry taking the lead with respect to the aspirational best practices that we've witnessed out there as to how the best run firms can achieve those fiduciary standards.
So several references have been made to getting Merrill Lynch to adopt this. Has anyone directly approached John Thiel or anyone at Merrill, and realistically speaking, is it ever going to happen? Since you brought it up.
Yeah, since I brought it up.
I mean, I know he was quoted, or he was exactly saying.
I have not approached John Thiel, but what I know is how he was quoted, and I'm not aware that he's retracted those remarks. So I'm hoping that somehow this will find his way to his inbox, and we'll see what happens.
Might I add, one of the ways in which the big Wall Street firms will change, you'll read it in the headlines from time to time in publications like Investment News, where a $3 billion firm left today or yesterday. Practices on an individual practitioner level, that's what this is aimed at. You're not going to change the industry from the top down, but you can change it from the inside out by giving the change behavior of the actual individual practitioners. That'll drag the industry with it.
So like yesterday, Devin Merrill.
I think that's what I was referring to.
The big guys jumped.
Yeah.
Now they went to a.
Well, let's hope they choose the right model.
But I called one of the heads of the team that stayed with Merrill, and he gave, if I could just throw this out there, he said, look, what's driving them is compensation. They could get more than 40% payout, and if they think that by being independent, the markets are going to change, or they're going to get better access to a trading desk, good luck to them.
Well, they could also charge their client half and make the same amount of money, so who benefits on that basis?
So I can tell you firsthand from working with that particular team for some time that what motivates them is indeed acting in the client's best interest, and that based upon their business model, they've actually foregone other revenue opportunities in order to have the most unconflicted business model that they could move forward with. It is a standard brokerage industry response that the move to independence is fueled by an increased payout, and that is at best short-sighted.
Yeah, no, those guys were there a long time. The one guy since '98. Why now? What's gotten worse? Do they say
stuff like this?
Well, and the nest has become more robust.
What's gotten worse?
If they're concerned about conflict,
where to go?
If they're concerned about conflict at Merrill, why did they wait all this time?
Technology, cloud, has enabled the stitching together of capabilities that didn't exist even 5 years ago.
Well, let's just applaud the fact that they're making these moves because this is exactly what we're hoping for. Because the independent broker-dealer world is relatively new in the world of financial services, maybe the early 90s, late 80s at the earliest, where you would see independent broker-dealers even pop up, where someone had a place to go other than just hanging a shingle with the SEC, which is daunting for a lot of people to do. It provided an alternate infrastructure for advisors to land that doesn't have these same conflicts. They have their own unique conflicts, perhaps, but they're much easily managed at a practice level.
So one of the first jobs I ever had, was at Merrill Lynch, and I can tell you that to this day, when you are there, you perceive the world as being flat. You're very unaware of the various options that are out there. You're keenly aware of the headline risks and the news that's coming out and the fact that you're playing defense with your client relationships, but you assume that everyone in the industry is doing that. What Jim alludes to is I think, the far more significant point. It's not why did it take them so long. It's look at the strength of resources that the independent model across channels, whether it's fee-only, whether it's a hybrid model, look at the breadth of resources that are now available to independent firms. I can tell you, as having been involved with just about every one of the billion-dollar-plus transitions over to independence over the last couple of years, that the interest among the top-tier teams has never been stronger. And it's the pain persists where they are, and that hasn't necessarily changed all that much. But what has changed is the resources, the relative value of the options that are available to them.
I really hope that this type of effort and other similar efforts play a role in catalyzing more of those types of changes. I think the educational outreach is helpful not only for investors but also for professionals, young professionals, and experienced professionals in our field. Knut and I were recently quoted in an article by April Rudin on the Huffington Post on hidden fees. And it's remarkable how few investors know about share classes, about 12b1 fees, about soft dollars. These are all standard industry terms. The supermarket equivalent is slotting fees, right? And the fees the manufacturers pay to get shelf space for the really sweet, really expensive cereal versus the generic, really healthy cereal. And I think the more this educational process progresses, and certainly with your help, with the media's help in reaching these investors, the more certain professionals will say, hey, there is a model out there. And by the way, it might be difficult to change from a model where we're charging a lot of 12B1 fees and to forego that income stream. It might be easier to just switch horses and go to a model that's built from the start from a different financial perspective.
I want to jump in on this. I know you all have sort of mentioned that you're looking at this from an individual practitioner level, a grassroots level, but has there been any discussion, you know, with the partners like Market Council, with NAPFA, with broker-dealers, sitting there and saying when these broker breakaway advisors do come over and starting this business from scratch, here's a, you know, list of best practices we think, you know, you might be willing to adhere to. Let's have a partnership from the ground up, build your business from there. Has there been any discussion about these kind of partnerships and having folks sign on from the get-go when they do enter the independent space?
So could I take this one since I'm kind of in that channel? I'll tell you what my hope is. But first, let me say that, and then I want to say something about the work that we're doing on the board. And we're not doing this for our benefit, meaning more competition is not necessarily good for us. We already have business models that work in the favor of the individuals. The fact that we're doing this is because we care. And I wanted to make that clear up front because we're inviting more people to compete with us down where we are. So I work, and I hope to do this with the council, to begin to go inside the broker-dealer world where possible and consult, how do I do that? Now, I do some speaking in my broker-dealer, and I've done presentations in my broker-dealer about our business model and how we did go from commission to fee-based, what it took. I think what you're going to get as these practices roll out is you're going to get a framework with which you can go into the practice management, and the independent BDs have this now, practice management consulting work that they can provide to recruit these big producing firms. They're actually wanting to implement this. They're looking for these resources. Obviously navigate some bureaucracy in their design and their legal departments and, you know, the Fiduciary Act and the way that they have to handle it. But they want something like this that they can turn around and use as a template and say, you know what, it's good for us, it's good for the client, it's good for you as a practitioner, and by the way, it's great for us to recruit and change the industry one practice at a time. So I think it's going to go hand in hand with that.
Well, for years, NAPFA's had a track at our conferences and outside for people who are looking to get into the RIA space, and we show you how you do it every step of the way. And it's been, well received.
How many non-RIAs show up at NAPFA conference?
It's not the majority of attendees.
I'm just wondering, you know, if these best practices are a practical tool rather than aspirational. Certainly down the line, there's going to be some verification process, but as it stands today, these are very aspirational, and having folks sign on to them is great, but, you know, what does that mean in everyday?
I think they're very practical, Megan, and that was our criteria in sitting down. We continue to challenge one another in, hey, how do folks achieve these, and how do we then measure that achievement? So I think it does create a template for how the best run firms are going to operate, those that aspire to fulfill the fiduciary standard. But Brian made a point that the work of the board is generally to invite in more people to compete within that space. I think the only prerequisite that they're asking for is that folks don a uniform, right, so that it's very clear to investors as to who is acting in the fiduciary capacity and who's not. Right, so I think, you know, there's the door is open for anyone to come in and act in this capacity, and yes, it does bring more competition into the space, but those that that have served the board, I know, invite that competition so long as the competitors are clear, and those that are working within other channels are also made clear.
I think what will also drive this, what maybe needs to be made explicit as opposed to implicit, is that these are targeted not just at advisors. These best practices are targeted at investors, and our hope is that investors will drive demand for these practices from their existing advisors, not just us influencing advisors. I think that would create a much greater shift, right, to the extent that investors around the country were going to their advisor and saying, do you do this? This is what I want. I want these best practices. Tell me where you are.
Let me jump in here. You asked a really good question in terms of whether they're practical or aspirational. And my friend Brian here uses the term aspirational. I want to be clear in terms of how I use that. If we remember what we aspired to when we went to college, probably most of us aspired to get very high grades. Our parents probably thought we should get all A's because we are above average. In that sense, to my mind, they are aspirational. This is a high standard. Now, that being said, I'm going back to something that Jack Bogle said earlier in terms of best interest. You know, what does it mean by itself? And in this day and age, it means absolutely nothing. There is no meaning to it. So I would say that these practices are very practical in terms of being able to measure with some specificity in terms of where someone's practice is. To be required to state in writing that you are a fiduciary is concrete and verifiable. To have a written engagement agreement is concrete and verifiable. That's not aspirational. That's practical. And so I think in that sense, it's important, in my view, that these practices have aspired to be concrete and verifiable. There's, you know, you do have a written engagement agreement or you don't. I don't know that there's any middle road there that I've discovered, but again, you know. So I think it's either you do or you don't. So in that sense, I think they're very kind.
Let me add something to what.
Let me clarify my question a little bit because maybe I'm not asking it correctly. You have this template for advisors, for investors to ask advisors, are you adhering to this? How do you get the word out that this template exists?
Yes.
You have firms like Market Council and NAPFA saying to their members, to their clients, here's a template, here's what you can use. You obviously have the media, but how do you get the word out?
I think if it's omitted, how are clients even going to know?
Megan, I think that's the right way to phrase the question, because I would build on what Knut said. At the firm level and even at the individual advisor level, he's very practical. It's at the industry level, and how much of an impact we make in the industry is where the aspiration lies. And how do you get the word out? Where do investors learn today? It's from the millions of dollars spent by insurance companies and, you know, Wall Street firms, right? We look to you, right? The media needs to help educate the consumers. And I would say, we get educated consumers who come to us, who ask some of the right questions. The matter is, what are all of the right questions? So, yes, that's the right questions. How do you get this body of knowledge and these practices out into the public domain so that it's simple for people to find, simple for people to ask, and simple for people to understand? And today, they're getting all kinds of mixed messages on TV and social media that if you don't know what we all know at this table, you go, wow, that's right. I agree with that commercial. Or I'm going to like that Facebook page, and I'm going to sign that petition. And what you're doing is lining up behind special interests who are filling the coffers of some elected officials to vote against fiduciary standards that protect the consumer.
Can I circle back to where we started then? I mean, you know, Matthew's been trying to do this since about 83.
Right.
Seems like the best opportunity, everyone who's championing the fiduciary standard has, is right now with the DOL. So do you guys want to say where you think it'll end and whether is that just being, is it going to be diluted enough so that the industry will be happy and every insurance agent and every congressional district won't have to worry?
One of my big frustrations is that this becomes to DOL or not to DOL, that is the question.
Yeah.
I think that's totally missing.
Yeah.
I think what has happened with digital advice, I think that what has happened with the Kelly Blue Book of our industry and consumer reportsification, I think it's just democratization of data, and I think importantly the fact that we do have more transparency with the internet, with cloud-based and technology that enables breakaways to hit headline news. When a $3.3 billion breakaway happened this morning, John Steele's thinking about that, right? So it used to be that the $130 million team left, and he was like, oh, we'll recruit that by tomorrow. Well, you don't recruit $3.3 billion by tomorrow, right? And five support staff and seven advisors. I mean, that's a material breach in the dam. So I feel like it's not just DOL, it's not just Robo, it's not just that there's appropriateness. It's not just product transparency. It's not just those Schwab commercials. But it's the convergence of those things that are causing consumers to say, we're underfunded, we're upset, it's opaque, we want a better answer.
And so that goes back to the point that it's the investor demand that's going to create that watershed moment for the standard. It's nothing that we're talking about here. It's no amount of press. It's no support of any company or industry
organization. I hear you, and I go back to Newt saying, whatever your words were, it's absurd how little the most supposedly sophisticated investors understand clients. So,
and so these traditional
so much to do. So
right.
You know,
so just these traditional global financial institutions are going to have one of two ways really of dealing with this. They're either going to head in the direction of tightening employment constraints, imposing garden leave provisions, tinkering with their restrictive covenants, departing from the broker protocol. They're either going to do that and try to contain their workforce, or they're going to change their business practices. But one thing is for sure, over the coming months, if not couple of years, we will see substantial change with those large financial institutions.
But the contract will become clearer. Between models.
That's right.
That's really what we wanted. And we can't, this industry for too long has been sitting around waiting for someone to come in and write new rules.
Right.
We don't want to sit around and wait for regulators to do it. After all, they're regulators. They're not out here. They don't, and they are easily influenced by their own conflicts of interest. Okay, so we need to do this. That's really what this is about. We need to change this industry.
What's my question? So the question that's on the, around the table is how do investors interact with best practices? Could you, in your opening remarks, you had mentioned investor bill of rights. What's the relationship between the two?
Well, I mentioned that one of the next steps is to develop a bill of rights, and we will be reaching out to other groups to work with us to come up with a bill of rights that reflects the requirements in the best practices, but in a language that is much more, much even more accessible to investors in terms of what they should be looking for.
Megan, I want to come back to something you asked earlier that I didn't get a chance to answer. You asked how are we going to get this in front of the public. So there are a couple of channels that if we can get them on our side and recognize the benefit of this, one being the CFP board, the other being the Financial Planning Association. I'm a CFP, and I'm on the board of the local financial planning chapter in the D.C. area. And some people are where they stand. And so I think that this will also provide an opportunity for them to say, this is the direction we need to head as well, and we're going to figure out how to get there. And they can become a voice. And there are, I think, 70,000 members of CFP, right? And 35,000 members of the EFP or something like that. So there's a voice that you can tap into. Now, will they do that? Well, that remains to be seen. But so there are avenues to reach the public and the broader community. And you may know the DGA commercials by the CFP. That's a great start. Everybody knows that their financial advisor shouldn't be a DJ in disguise, right? But that's the kind of thing where the awareness really gets picked up.
Let me just ask, on the line, are there any questions?
I think you lowered the volume before.
No, I'll put it back up.
Want to ask again?
Are there any questions on the line? It looks like there are three calls coming in.
They're all on mute and don't know it.
Yes, you might be on mute because we're not hearing you, or you might have gone on to your next meeting. Okay, back to the table.
Okay. Are there any more questions from our friends in the media? And if not, I think I want to thank everybody for joining us. Thank our industry panel. Thank Mr. Hamburger. Thank you to Jack Bogle for kicking this off. And as you can see, that we will have more news coming down the track. So, thank you.
Thanks to InvestNet for hosting us.
Thanks to everybody. Thanks to Merrill for losing us brokers today.
They disconnected.
Yeah.